Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when you want to have a baby but can't? An estimated 10 to 15% of couples who wish to conceive a child will have trouble conceiving or sustaining a pregnancy due to problems that can arise for either would-be parent or both. Yet while there are still no guarantees that medical intervention will result in a healthy baby, scientists have made great strides in diagnosing and treating the underlying causes of infertility. My two guests are here to talk about that and to answer some of your questions throughout the hour. Dr. Bruce Carr is professor of obstetrics and gynecology and director of the Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility Fellowship Program at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Satine Patel of Texas Health Resources is board certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology and subspecialty board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Welcome, both of you, and your lengthy titles to Think.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. How do doctors define infertility?
Well, generally, infertility is defined as a couple not being able to conceive after 1 year of regular unprotected intercourse. The exception to that rule is women over 35, where we like to start diagnostic evaluation after 6 months of trying.
Mm-hmm. Are men and women equally likely to have issues with fertility?
Yes. I mean, that's not very well understood by most men, but definitely they make up a large percentage, at least 40% cause of infertility. Mm-hmm. And there may be a male factor and a female factor as well.
So when a new patient comes into you, what kinds of questions do you want to ask before you've even run any tests or done an exam?
Well, the history is a very important part of the diagnostic process. The things that we generally start off with is assessing the frequency of a woman's menstrual cycles. Any evidence of irregular cycles may imply that she is not ovulating consistently. The frequency of intercourse is also something that we look into quite commonly. Additionally, it's very important to get an idea of any history of sexually transmitted diseases that could potentially cause scar tissue in a woman's fallopian tubes. An occlusion of the fallopian tubes could result in impaired sperm and embryo transport, and that is also a very common cause of infertility.
Mm-hmm. Do couples who are hoping to conceive, do they need to be on any kind of like schedule with intercourse, or is nature and people's desire usually sufficient to allow healthy folks to get pregnant when they want to?
Well, the majority of patients, it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But in some patients, if they have to have, they're not ovulating normally, or if there's a low sperm count, then that may be a problem. So one thing that a patient could do to determine if she's ovulating is she could take her basal body temperature, but most women are not willing to do that anymore, and they use these home urinary LH or ovulation predictor kits, and then they can time intercourse when they see a surge or a change in the color from on the urine strip.
Because women are actually fertile for just a couple of days every month, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Why is 35 such a critical cutoff age? Is that somewhat arbitrary based on the averages?
That's based on particularly IVF data, mm-hmm. where after age 35, pregnancy rates and live birth rates continue to drop very rapidly. So by age 45, the chance of conceiving on their own is very, very low.
A few years ago, there was like a spate of news articles about women delaying childbirth and thinking they could have a baby whenever. Has that been your experience in practice that women are unaware that, you know, that things get harder as they get older?
Absolutely, and I think the growing prevalence of infertility we can largely attribute to the fact that women are tending to delay childbearing to later years for a variety of reasons, like Dr. Carr mentioned, essentially the egg cohort drops significantly getting into the early to mid-30s. And oftentimes patients don't realize it because it's relatively asymptomatic until they actually actively try to conceive.
Even though we've been trying to educate them, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has made a big issue of this. It seems that we see patients every week that they don't know anything about this problem.
Does the father's, would-be father's age matter at all?
Probably to some degree, maybe over age 50, there may be some decline in sperm counts and sort of motility, but in general, men can have motile sperm and fertilize throughout their lifetime.
All right, so what kinds of tests do you start with when a patient comes to you and is having trouble conceiving?
So the basic infertility evaluation involves checking for fallopian tube patency, and we do that via what we call a hysterosalpingogram, a tubal dye study, essentially. Additionally, we evaluate a woman's uterine cavity to make sure there are not any structural defects, such as fibroids or polyps or any sort of birth defects of the uterus. It's important to check a man's semen analysis to make sure he has adequate numbers and function of sperm, given that's the culprit in up to a third of cases. In reference to a woman waiting to conceive in later years, it's imperative to check a woman's ovarian reserve. And most commonly, we do that with a combination of an AMH test, which is a hormone that the remaining eggs in the ovary secrete, in addition to what we call an antral follicle count, by looking at the number of developing small follicles in a woman's ovaries via ultrasound.
Are you able to tell whether the eggs that an older woman who wishes to get pregnant has are still viable?
That's hard to tell. So other than just looking at their ovarian reserve, as you mentioned, by looking at their how many antral follicles we see in an ultrasound test and looking at their AMH, that's really what we have. But surprisingly, utilizing specific kinds of protocols like low stimulation protocols, we are able to get some of these patients pregnant in their 43 through 45, which you won't know until you really try.
How do you have to manage expectations when patients come to you? Do they go and say, oh, thank goodness, I'm in your office and now we'll be able to have this baby?
Well, it's oftentimes difficult because patients oftentimes do have unrealistic expectations, especially those that wait till later ages to attempt to conceive. Because of this, this is often very emotionally charged process.
Do most couples seek counseling separate and apart from fertility treatments, or is that something that you recommend?
Well, we offer that if they're going through extended cycles. If we're going to go through in vitro fertilization, we always recommend counseling. We offer that because it is emotional and very stressful.
Do you get emotionally wrapped up in the cases of your patients? I mean, I would imagine that to a lesser degree, it's frustrating when they're frustrated and really exhilarating when things go well.
Certainly, at times it can be very frustrating, especially in cases of repeated IVF failures. But on the flip side, we have made big strides in terms of success rates and in terms of newer techniques and are helping patients to conceive that in the past wouldn't be able to have that success. I think in my experience, one of the most challenging populations are patients where they essentially don't have many eggs, any good quality eggs left in their reserve. And the surge of the use of donor eggs in this population has really been pretty rewarding in terms of offering those patients another option to conceive.
And on the flip side, this is one of the most rewarding things for reproductive endocrinologists to have a patient get pregnant and bring your baby back to see you.
I was really surprised doing a little bit of research in advance of our discussion. I think most women know they shouldn't smoke while they're pregnant. I was surprised that tobacco use by either partner can be a factor in infertility.
That appears to be true.
Mm-hmm. What might be going on there?
Well, actually, it's probably the byproduct of one of cigarette smoking that may affect the egg and sperm. So it's a factor, and we know that there may be increased risk of miscarriage as well as in smokers as well, premature labor. So,
and it's important for both partners to be at a healthy weight.
Very critical. And that is one thing that we're fighting every day, and we talked about that earlier, that if their BMI gets up above 35, we really start seeing problems. We see more problems with ovulation problems. We see problems if we have to do any surgery on these patients, retrieving the eggs could be a problem. And then once they get pregnant, if they have a high BMI, everything can go wrong during pregnancy. For example, premature labor, miscarriage rates are markedly increased. And also, again, with the ovulation rates, they may be less likely to respond to our standard drugs. They require higher doses of drugs. And we published a paper years ago comparing various drugs in the New England Journal of Medicine 2007, we found a major correlation that the live birth rates were less with women's BMI over 35 compared to women's BMI that were less than 30.
So I would imagine this is something that you've observed a lot more in recent years as the problems this country's having with obesity have grown.
Absolutely. The prevalence of obesity, unfortunately, is rising very steadily, and that's been exacerbating the issue, including infertility as well. But fortunately, there are good interventions for these patients. Behavioral modification tends to be quite effective, and in more extreme cases, gastric surgery has also been shown to help these patients as well, not just lose weight, but also oftentimes resume normal ovulatory cycles as well and become fertile on their own.
Mm-hmm. Talk about secondary infertility, which I guess is being unable to conceive after having a couple's had a healthy baby once before. Is that right?
Yes, that's probably most likely related to their age and reduced ovarian reserve, I think, because mm-hmm. unless they have developed, or it could be also the husband's sperm count has dropped, which I've seen patients where they had a child maybe 6-7 years ago and they had no trouble then, and then we come in and do a semen analysis and it's markedly reduced for some reason.
And are there risks involved, greater risks with bearing a child with some kind of assistive technique than doing it the old-fashioned way?
Not that we know of. With standard infertility treatments, consisting of inseminations and whatnot, the biggest risk generally that we encounter is multiple gestation, especially mm-hmm. when we use injectable medications.
Twins, triplets,
et cetera, quadruplets, et cetera. And when we're using injectable medications with IUI, generally your risk of twins is about a third, and your risk of triplets is around 5-10% or so, which we try to minimize at all costs for a variety of reasons. And with IVF, per se, in terms of birth defects, studies have shown that it's actually a very safe procedure and there is not a higher risk of birth defects with in vitro compared to naturally conceived babies.
There may be with the procedure called ICSI, which you inject a sperm into the egg, there's some data to suggest that we may see slightly increased abnormalities compared to standard IVF where the sperm and egg are just allowed to fertilize normally.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how tiny are the tools when you are injecting a sperm into an egg? What is that? Is it a needle? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a micro needle, and it's done under a microscope, and it takes a significant amount of training. We don't do that. That's usually done by the embryologist.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very time-consuming, and the training takes a while.
I can imagine you'd have to have incredibly steady hands and tools that make that even
absolutely
possible.
Absolutely.
We're speaking this hour about issues with infertility with Dr. Satin Patel of Texas Health Resources. He's board certified by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology and subspecialty board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Dr. Bruce Carr is here as well. He is professor of obstetrics and gynecology and director of the Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility Fellowship Program at UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you've got a question or perhaps you'd like to share a story, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th. Now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about treating infertility with Dr. Bruce Carr, professor of obstetrics and gynecology and director of the Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility Fellowship Program at UT Southwestern. Dr. Satin Patel is with North Texas IVF, and he is an obstetrician and gynecologist with a subspecialty in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Or email think@kera.org. This almost sounds like a funny question to ask, but are problems with fertility, do they run in families?
Unless maybe if they had significant disease with like endometriosis or fibroids, but it's also possible that the mother had premature ovarian failure, went through menopause early. That might be. Those are the three things I can think of right now.
Mm-hmm. How much of this treatment is covered by health insurance?
Well, fortunately, the majority of patients have some sort of diagnostic coverage, so that tends to help at least in terms of finding answers regarding their infertility in a large portion of patients. However, as for treatment, it's quite uncommon for patients to have treatment for, coverage for treatment, although a small percentage of patients we do find have some coverage.
Do you counsel patients to think about sort of a final strategy if things have not worked out, if they haven't been able to successfully conceive and bear a child? Do they have to think at the outset of treatment what they'll do if it doesn't work the way they hope?
Why spend time with them at the first visit, depending on their age and everything, to give them a game plan? We're going to try this for a while, and then if this doesn't work, we're going to try this. And at the end of that, that's probably all we can really offer them.
Mm-hmm.
So they may get 6-7 therapeutic cycles. That could be this intrauterine insemination, or it could be IVF cycles.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have a tweet here to me at Chris Boyd Think that says, what are the negative side effects of birth control? For example, trouble waking up the reproductive system after suppression.
So we do see that at times in women that have taken oral contraceptives for a long period of time, their ovaries can be somewhat dormant. When we evaluate their ovarian reserve to determine how many eggs they have left in their ovaries, however, it's almost always very temporary. Usually, after they discontinue their pills for 1 to 3 months, the ovary resumes normal function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a recent study. It's not been published yet from Europe where they showed that one of the mechanisms of birth control pills is that it does lower their AMH and it does reduce the number of antral follicles, like Dr. Patel said. But it appears to be temporary. And it appears to be temporary, maybe, I agree, 3 to 6 months, they'll be back to normal.
How does prior cancer treatment sometimes interfere with a couple's ability to conceive?
Well, depending on which chemotherapeutic agent that was used, chemotherapy can be potentially very damaging to a woman's ovarian reserve. For that reason, we strongly encourage patients that are about to undergo chemotherapy to see a fertility specialist in order to do an expedited cycle to harvest her eggs for freezing, or in the case of a male, to collect sperm and freeze it prior to chemotherapy.
The techniques for freezing eggs have markedly improved in the last 4 or 5 years by a technique called vitrification, and so the success rates appear to be much better. Now that leads to the question about if a young patient comes to your office and wants to save her eggs and freeze them because she is not married yet or not ready to get pregnant. That's a controversial area, but it's currently being more and more accepted.
Why is that controversial?
It's controversial because up to a few years ago, it was considered to be experimental.
Hmm.
So it's still on that borderline thing. For the cancer patients, we both agree. For the others, that's true too. So one way, another thing in that that stance is, should a patient check her AMH when she's 30 or 25? And if it's low, then freeze her eggs if she's not married. That's another a new concept that is coming about currently.
So it could become standard that a gynecologist recommends that women who come in just for an exam undergo these tests.
Absolutely. I think the trend will move towards that in efforts to be proactive. If we're proactive and freeze a woman's eggs while her reserve is still good, the results are going to be much higher than when you're trying to treat a problem of having low ovarian reserve.
Yeah, I think we all agree with that.
So you mentioned earlier that multiple births are a risk and something that you try whenever possible to avoid. And I think most people understand that the human body is not as well suited to multiple babies at one time. What about for couples who feel like this will be their only shot? And are there people who request multiple fertilization?
Yes. But that's to me, is not controversial. I don't recommend that at all, because even though it's beautiful to have twins, the complication from twin pregnancies is significant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, premature labor, then at least a mental retardation in the child. It's really, really risky.
The risk of cerebral palsy with the twin is sevenfold higher than for the singleton, and for the triplet is 20-fold higher in at least one fetus. So I agree that the risks are very high, and this is something that we have control over. And with newer techniques, especially with IVF, such as pre-implantation genetic screening, we can actually biopsy an embryo and determine whether it's chromosomally normal or not prior to putting it back in, and get pregnancy rates exceeding 50% to 60% with a single embryo being transferred. So really, there in this day and age, the threshold for having multiple births, again, should be very high.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Georgia in Tyler. Hi, Georgia.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I had three births in 1970. The first birth, I lost my child. They were all premature births, and I have been able to piece it back together as of a couple of weeks ago, getting understanding what happened and how I lost my baby. The thing that happened was that I had periodontal disease.
Is that a risk factor for miscarriage?
Well, I think she's describing premature labor rather than miscarriages.
Uh-huh.
Those are usually before 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And if these are premature labor, it's possible that she could have some systemic bacterial infection that could lead to that problem, but it's not well documented.
Mm-hmm. What do you suggest to just general couples who want to get themselves healthy and be prepared to conceive, say, in the next year or so?
I think observing a healthy diet, low in saturated fats, relatively low in carbohydrates, is very important. Maintaining a healthy weight, to stop smoking if the patient smokes, to minimize alcohol use as well, mm-hmm. on regular exercise. I think that's very important.
So the advice is pretty much the same no matter what kind of physician you are. Being healthy is being healthy.
And prenatal
actually.
Vitamins,
mm-hmm.
especially with folic acid.
And folic acid prevents spina bifida?
Neural tube defects, yes. Mm-hmm. Spina bifida is an example.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Amanda in Denton. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
I was diagnosed with PCOS or PCOD in 2008, and at the time, the doctor basically just kind of handed me a packet, and there was very little information available to me at that time, and I've been kind of researching it online. I've noticed that awareness and information has definitely grown. I'm in the process. I just got married, and we are wanting to conceive soon, and I'm just kind of wanting to know what new information is out there and you know, how popular is PCOS?
PCOS is actually incredibly prevalent in the population. It's thought to affect 7 to 10% of reproductive age couples.
Let me jump in. Polycystic ovary syndrome.
Yes, polycystic ovary syndrome. So, termed PCOS. Like I said, it affects 7 to 10% of reproductive age to women. So it's very prevalent. The important things to realize about PCOS is that the majority of patients have irregular cycles, and if you experience cycles less frequent than every 3 to 4 months, you'll put yourself at higher risk for endometrial hyperplasia, which is a precursor to cancer. So that's a big deal. If you are trying to get pregnant, again, I would seek help from a reproductive endocrinologist. And if you're not at this time, at least get on the birth control pill to protect your uterine lining. Additionally, patients with PCOS that are at a markedly higher risk of diabetes as well. So really underscoring the importance of maintaining a healthy lifestyle and a healthy weight in order to prevent or reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes in the future. And from an infertility perspective, we know that patients with PCOS tend to have a much higher likelihood of having problems conceiving. And what I recommend to patients is to try at earlier ages and do not delay childbearing in this situation, because a large portion of PCOS patients tend to have issues with poor egg quality as they get older.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Alexis in Dallas. Hi, Alexis.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I'm 29 years old, and I am of Asian descent, and I have been on metformin and several other medications. Now, I do not get my period at all. I got married about 6 years ago, and I have gained weight from that. And I did used to get my period normally, but now I just don't. And unless I'm given Provera, which is medication for, you know, having lack of progesterone in your system. Now, is there any other tips? Because I know IVF is extremely expensive, and I don't have health insurance or anything like that. What else is there that I can do? Because I've already tried IUI. I've already, you know, I'm currently doing acupuncture. Is there anything else I can do better?
Well, let me make sure, Alexis, that you know that the gentleman here, since they haven't examined you, they'll speak in a very general sense about, I suppose, the kinds of things that – is it even possible to answer that question?
Well, in general, so if a patient has polycystic ovarian syndrome and, like she states, she's not having periods very often, she definitely needs treatment by a reproductive endocrinologist or advanced gynecologist. And the treatments would be – the standard treatments would be a drug called clomiphene citrate. I don't know if she's taken that or not. In addition to that, we, depending on her body weight, sometimes clomiphene citrate plus metformin is helpful, or clomiphene plus low-dose dexamethasone. All those are options. Now, there is a new drug that has come on the market called letrozole. It's an aromatase inhibitor. And in a large study, it proved to be a little bit better than Clomid as far as live birth rates. But it does contain it has a black box warning that it says to the patient when they get the prescription that they should not use this if they're trying to get pregnant. But that was based on an abstract of a few abnormal babies many years ago. And the Reproductive Medicine Network and the FDA did approve the letrozole Clomid comparison study. So we're waiting for a few more societies to come out saying it's okay is another option. So those are not super expensive drugs. They don't necessarily require a intrauterine insemination, depending on whether she ovulated. But you take the fertility drugs, you then check a blood test to make sure in the midluteal phase called a progesterone level, and if it's elevated to a normal range, then she's probably ovulated.
Are these drugs tough on people just emotionally when in terms of the hormone swings that it sounds like you're describing sound challenging to deal with?
Well, clomiphene can certainly cause unwanted side effects. It's probably the least desired drug that fertility patients take in terms of side effects. It can make patients moody, irritable, almost feel like being in a menopausal state. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we do counsel patients on ahead of time. Letrozole, on the other hand, tends to have less of these effects and tends to be tolerated better by patients.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Dana in Fort Worth. Hi, Dana.
Hi. I'm calling a young man that I know who is around 25 years old, had been treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma a couple of years ago, and he elected not to have any of his sperm frozen. And I wonder, what are the chances that his fertility will return?
Well, it's variable. I think what he needs to do is just to go to his doctor and have him order a semen analysis and see what the status is right now.
Are young men counseled in the same way that young women are when they go through something like cancer treatment with regard to the effects potentially on their fertility?
Unfortunately, not as common as we would like. One of the largest studies looking at how often fertility preservation is brought up to patients about to start chemotherapy has shown that less than 20% of patients actually counseled of this option by hematologists and oncologists. So we really are trying to increase the awareness of how important this is, because in the past, the goal was mainly focused on survival of patients from the cancer. But now, as cancer cure rates have improved significantly, family building options are an increasing concern for patients.
The oncologists at UT Southwestern are becoming more aware of this in the last few years, and we're joining together to make sure that when they see a patient that they consider this, and they're all on board for this.
You mentioned earlier, Dr. Carr, that or maybe it was you, Dr. Patel, that embryos can be screened to find those that are healthy genetically and appear to be in the best position to grow into a healthy baby. Some people worry that this will lead to someone saying, well, I want my child to be at least 5'7", and I want this and that. Is that something that any sort of reputable doctors are willing to entertain at this point?
Well, we don't really know the genes, first of all. We don't really know the genes that control height and eye color and hair color and this sort of thing, and that's probably a good thing. But one thing that is of some controversy is gender selection. That request is more and more prevalent nowadays. Families, for example, who have a boy in the family want to have a girl that don't have infertility, they can go through this procedure and select the desired gender. And that's becoming more and more common.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We are speaking this hour about infertility with two experts, Dr. Bruce Carr of UT Southwestern Medical Center and Dr. Satine Patel of North Texas IVF. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about infertility with two experts in obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Dr. Bruce Carr joins us from UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Satine Patel is here from North Texas IVF. If you want to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Anna in Dallas. Hi, Anna.
Hi, I appreciate your fielding the question. I have a sister-in-law that has Kallmann syndrome, and she and my brother very much want children, and they're going through IVF treatment. And I was just wondering, you know, I know they're already under a doctor's care, but every doctor can bring perhaps a different piece to the table. So I was wondering whether you all might have any specific suggestions for them or other people they could see that might help them.
So with Kallmann syndrome, it's essentially patients have a deficiency of gonadotropins coming from their pituitary or originating from the hypothalamus. And essentially with IVF, we're going around that because we're giving these drugs in medication in injectable form. So the management would be the same as if the patient had an intact hypothalamic pituitary axis.
Those particular types of patients may tend to hyperstimulate. So I think doing an IVF cycle is probably preferable than giving her just the gonadotropins and doing intrauterine insemination. So I think whatever that – I don't know if she's tried that before, but – during the stimulation cycle, it's likely that she may get lots of follicles and have her estrogen go up. So there's an option he may need to freeze embryos in that case and transfer them in another cycle. That's really the only thing I would think of, but they may not be needed.
We have an email here from Sam who wonders if IVF babies are more susceptible to things like Asperger's or migraines or other brain or psychological defects.
I don't think there's any evidence for that at this point in time. We've been following these babies since
1980. Louise Brown, right?
Yes, that's right, 1980.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go now to Melissa in Dallas. Hi, Melissa.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, how does diseases such as bipolar disorder or mental, incapabilities affect infertility? Because I am 30 right now, and I'm thinking about having children, but I'm reading a lot of the medications that I'm taking for my depression, and they say don't take them if you're trying to get pregnant. So how do I manage that with trying to have a baby?
Well, first of all, I think it's imperative that you're under the care of a psychiatrist doing not just the fertility process, but more importantly, during the time of delivery and the early postpartum stage as well. Although bipolar disease itself does not affect a woman's fertility that we know of, a lot of the psychotropic medications can potentially lead to birth defects. In terms of antidepressive agents, the SSRIs such as Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil, studies have shown that there's a slightly higher risk of cardiac malformations with these medications that you should be aware of. Although the absolute risk isn't very high, it is a significantly increased risk in terms of statistics. Additionally, there's an increased incidence of newborn irritability as well in patients that have been on SSRIs throughout their pregnancy. In certain instances, benefits outweigh the risks, and that's why it's very important to have a psychiatrist who's familiar with your case on board throughout the entire process.
And also the obstetrician should be involved in this, because patients that have this problem are very likely to undergo a postpartum depression at a markedly increased incidence, and that could be very deleterious to the outcome of her raising her baby and her husband's association with her, et cetera.
Sure. How open are people to the idea of using donor sperm, donor eggs, surrogate mothers? Is acceptance of this of these practices growing?
To some degree, but I've seen couples like last week. I came in and said, we can offer donor sperm rather than go through an ICSI procedure that may or may not work. And again, it's a lot less expensive. But many, particularly the males, are less likely to want to use donor sperm.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of personal viewpoints, religious viewpoints, can also play into this as well. What we tend to do is before we use any donor sperm or donor eggs or even using a surrogate, we require patients to see one of our reproductive psychologists really to understand the entire psychosocial aspects of their decision and the subsequent implications on their family.
Agree.
When you are dealing with same-sex couples, and I suppose you would only deal with same-sex couples of women since you're OBGYNs, you're shaking your head no?
Yeah, well, we also do assist same-sex male couples as well.
Okay. How do you help the couple make the determination as to which partner might be better suited to carry a pregnancy?
That decision is multifaceted. One, it's often a personal decision. One partner may want to start off doing carrying the baby, et cetera. It's very common in the case of same-sex female couples for one partner to use her egg, and the other partner to actually carry the pregnancy, mm-hmm. to be more involved in the entire process. But it's a very personal decision. Of course, if there are underlying medical problems in one of the partners, that would influence our recommendation in terms of who should carry the pregnancy, or if one of them have had a history of obstetrical complications or whatnot, that would also sway our recommendations one way or the other.
Or if a patient had, one of the patients, the couple had polycystic ovarian syndrome, or the other one had huge fibroids, that would influence the decision.
Right, because you would want to recommend that the patient most likely to have a successful pregnancy
right.
do so. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question. 5 years ago, I went and had some tests done because we couldn't have kids, me and my wife. And they told me at that time that the tubes, they were like fogged, I guess. And I just wanted to see if that's reversible and is it expensive?
Well, I can answer that question. Years ago, before we had modern IVF techniques, we did a lot of tubal surgery. So I had a lot of experience doing that from many years ago. And the outcomes were depending on how severe they were damaged. I mean, pregnancy rates at the best would maybe be 40 or 50%. Generally, we always quote like maybe 20 to 15% if we did surgery. And, of course, you have to have insurance to have the surgery, so it's not going to be cheap. And today, if we do an X-ray to show marketed blocked tubes, most of us would refer for IVF because the pregnancy rates are much, much higher, like 40, 50% at a young patient.
Mm-hmm. And the other issue is cost. In the past, IVF was so expensive, and tubal surgery was a less expensive option. But nowadays, with IVF, costing $5,000 to $6,000 a cycle, it being less than tubal surgery, there's not as big of a role for tubal surgery compared to IVF.
How reversible is a vasectomy? You see these billboards on the side of the road, and I wonder if that's a realistic option for most families.
Yeah, if you have a vasectomy, it depends on how long it's been. There's data to show that if the vasectomy is longer than 10 years, that it may not be, the sperm quality may not be as good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very simple procedure to do. It can be done as day surgery. We do the same thing. We're putting fallopian tubes back together on a mini lap and setting the patient open the same day. So those procedures are fairly successful. If for the female, I could quote like a 50% pregnancy rate if they're under age 35 for a tubal reversal. I don't know about male versus since we don't do those.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bethany in Fort Worth. Hi, Bethany.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in reference to the effects of an abortion on fertility in later years. I was young and dumb and had big dreams, and then I tried hard drugs, trusting people I should not have. So 8 years ago, I quit, and I'm 32 now. I had abortions, and it was not an environment I wanted to bring a child into. So now that I'm quit, and I've got my life in order, and I have a happy husband, how has that possibly affected my fertility?
Well, chances are that it shouldn't affect your fertility at all. One thing to realize, however, that theoretically, during an abortion procedure, a DNC is often performed as well, which is a scraping of the endometrial lining. So there is a small potential for some scar tissue to exist in the uterine cavity, and that can be screened for by your reproductive endocrinologist with what we call a saline ultrasound, where they can make sure that's not the case. But chances are you're just fine in terms of your fertility.
Except maybe for her age.
She said 32.
32.
So that's, she's getting close to...
That was 6 years ago she had the procedure, so that's 6 years loss of fertility. That's how we kind of look at it. We get pretty serious about this problem, that if you want to get pregnant, start now.
This sounds like something that frustrates you because I guess we're not going to change. Women's bodies are not going to change to accommodate the way we live today.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, no question. Women are educated. Actually, more women are going to medical school than men, for example, and they're all delaying childbirth. Most of them are. If you went back to the 50s and 40s, women had many pregnancies and had them much earlier because there wasn't effective contraception. So it's a problem because they come to us and we know that we could have recommended something earlier if they would have tried, and they may, and we see some of our female residents now, knowing about all the problems, they're having their children while they're still residents in their just late 20s, early 30s.
I'm just going to say that can't be easy.
No, it can't be easy to have a baby and do a residency in OBGYN at Parkland Hospital for sure.
Do people need to start thinking about, I mean, it's hard to, you know, get teenagers to think about much more than contraception if you can get them there. But is this something that we need to think about in terms of our lifelong health that maybe most people don't even consider until, you know, 6 months before they hope to become pregnant?
I'm not sure what.
Well, yeah. are people paying enough attention to staying reproductively healthy? Or for most people, does this just happen and they don't have to think about it?
Yeah, I think it's probably, it just happens in most mm-hmm. patients.
Mm-hmm. I think when you speak of reproductively healthy, I think a lot of it just really pertains to generally being healthy. Mm-hmm. For example, refraining from smoking and limiting alcohol consumption and leading a healthy lifestyle. There's not much else you can do other than not delay childbearing into later years.
Of course, using drugs is another thing that patients are not worried if they may reduce the chance for fertility. We know that marijuana will certainly reduce sperm counts in men. Mm-hmm. We don't have as much information out in women, but probably with the onset of the splurge of marijuana in states like California and Washington, we may find something happening in the next few years.
What have you learned from your patients about how any of us can be a supportive friend or family member to a couple that is experiencing infertility? It seems like people are just really good at saying the wrong thing.
I think that's a very important point there. That oftentimes our couples going through infertility treatment have a lot of psychological burden going through and a lot of underlying depression as well. Fortunately, there are great support groups. The most well-known of them being Resolve here in Dallas as well. And many of our patients find comfort as well as identification with other couples going through a similar process. We also strongly encourage our patients who are open to it to visit with a reproductive psychologist as well and to not ignore the repercussions of going through fertility treatment. More often than not, it tends to be a roller coaster going through the process.
Yeah, I think the best group is what he's mentioned is Resolve. They seem to be the best group for, in my opinion, for a couple to be involved with. So they meet with other couples have the same problem and discuss their treatments and know that other people have this problem.
Dr. Bruce Carr is professor of obstetrics and gynecology and director of the Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility Fellowship Program at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Satin Patel joined us from North Texas IVF. He is also an obstetrician and gynecologist and is also certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. It's been wonderful to have both of you gentlemen with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect produced the show today, and she was helped out on the phones by Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.